In the psychiatrist's chair, Professor B.F. Skinner talks to Dr. Anthony Clare.
Boris Frederick Skinner was born on March the 20th, 1904, in the small town of Susquehanna in Pennsylvania. His father was a lawyer and a local politician. He once stood on successfully as the local Republican candidate for mayor, while his mother, Grace Madge Burris, was an amateur musician and worked as a stenographer before her marriage. His brother, Edward James, born 2 years after him, died suddenly in 1923 of a suspected cerebral hemorrhage. After attending a local school, Skinner studied English language and literature at Hamilton College, Clinton, where previous scholars included Ezra Pound. However, he became disillusioned with writing and turned to psychology, obtaining his M.A. and then his Ph.D. at Harvard. From the outset, he studied behavior, particularly in a series of celebrated experiments with rats and pigeons, and soon became recognized as the legitimate successor to J.B. Watson, sometimes called the father of behaviorism. The basic theory of behaviorist psychology is that actions which are rewarded or reinforced are strengthened, whereas those that are discouraged or not reinforced are extinguished. In a series of books, including Behavior of Organisms, published in 1938, and Science and Human Behavior, published in 1953, he has argued that human behavior is rather rigidly a function of the environmental influences to which they've been exposed from early life, and that there is a close analogy between the way Skinner's laboratory rats and pigeons behave in the experimental situation and the way in which human beings acquire their distinctive patterns of behavior. By applying his theory of reinforcement, Skinner was able to teach pigeons to walk in figures of eight and play ping pong. However, his real significance lies in his insistence that it is proper and indeed desirable to apply the methods and procedures of behavioral psychology to the human domain. Whereas other behavioral psychologists seem, for the most part, content to apply their theories to individual patients and problems, Skinner seeks to recondition society itself. In his fictional work, Walden 2, he envisaged a new society in which stability, harmony, and satisfaction are behaviorally engineered. In an even more controversial work, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, he proposes that the notion of autonomous free man be abandoned altogether. Professor Skinner has two daughters, having married in 1936. In other interviews in this series, I've opened by asking the individuals concerned how they felt about talking about themselves, about their inner feelings and experiences, and the values and attitudes. Professor Skinner, how do you feel about talking about yourself, given your somewhat uncompromising view about the importance, or perhaps the non-importance, of the inner man?
Well, let me say first that I, as a behaviorist, I nevertheless admit that I have feelings, and I feel the condition of my body when I'm doing various things, and I make use of that as important data. I have always regarded myself as no more or less than the organisms I study. Much more complicated than a rat or a pigeon, but the same kind of nervous system made of the same types of cells and tissues. And I deal with myself in precisely the same ways in which I deal with an organism. If I want to get an experimental organism to do a particular kind of thing, I arrange a setting in which it is likely to do it, and then by reinforcing that behavior, I make it more likely to do it, and I can build up a repertoire. And I do it with myself. I arrange a world in which I am more likely to do the kinds of things which I find rewarding.
Now, we'll come back, I'm sure, to this issue of feelings again, but given what you've described, it fits very neatly with what I always do with people in my chair. Yes. That is, I say, well, right, let's go back. You've written an autobiography, and when I look in it, one of the first things I notice is that in your early environment, you make several references to it being itself highly controlled.
Yes.
you wrote, "My parents' control was so well sustained that I had no chance to learn to revolt. I was never quite free." Yes. Now, they're interesting words that you used. In what way were they?
Well, the control was aversive. It was punitive, really. In spite of the fact that I don't remember ever being spanked, I did record that my mother once washed my mouth out. Mm. This was a baptismal ritual of cleansing the mouth after I'd used a bad word. And that was the only physical control that I remember at all. However, very early, there would be a tut-tut kind of thing. If I did something that offended people, I would be asked to think, what will people think if you do that? And my father, although he didn't punish me physically, did go out of his way to let me see a jail. That was his professional, as a lawyer, his professional type of control. I think he wanted to prepare me to lead a legal life and felt that some glimpse of the punishments impending. Then, of course, I was rather strongly threatened by my grandmother's description of hellfire and that kind of thing. These were the controls exercised in a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture at that time. Religion, the police, and what people will think.
Did they express their feelings? Now, I realize I'm on difficult ground here. I have to explain what I mean. Were they physically very affectionate people, or was that very controlled?
No, they didn't quite know how to be affectionate. My father didn't know how to adjust to me and be the kind of father he would have liked to be. My mother was both affectionate. She was also punitive.
The other picture that comes across of your father, a complex man, a man who had in turn inserted into him great ambition, as I understood from his mother, and he'd never lived up to it.
No, he was never quite prepared for every stage of advancement. He did move up in the world, but he never quite knew how to behave at the new level at which he'd arrived. Mm. I feel very sorry for my father. Mm. My mother was always there to criticize him, and did. And I'm sure that she really led him a rather miserable life, although she didn't know that she was doing it.
Now, the question I want to ask you is, given the importance of these things in your model, as indeed in mine, could you say something to me about what you think the impact of those two people on you has been?
I think it's very clear. I think I could claim to have done more than anyone I can think of at the present time in exploring alternatives to punishment, ways of getting people to learn, to behave well, to treat each other well, which do not require punishment. It's made me, and many of my colleagues have often wondered, why are you so down on punishment? And the answer may be the question you ask. Is this my reaction to the subtle punitive control exerted by my father and mother? And it could very well be.
Yes. A reaction, in fact.
Yes, but I now turn, whenever I can, to positive reinforcement. I make so much of the positive side of things. How can you build a world in which people will not need to be threatened, to be punished, either by religious agencies, governmental agencies, or economically by failure, and so on?
The other thing I wondered about was, you write, sometimes movingly, sometimes rather detached, about your father's periodic bouts of terrible self-doubt, when he would weep and so on.
Yes, right.
I wasn't clear the age that you were when these various things were happening, but I presume it was an important age. You were still growing. And I wonder...
About 24 at the time.
Oh, it was later.
When it was acute. When he had made this very bad decision to go into practice for himself in a new city and so on, and things were not going well. My mother was afraid he might commit suicide. Mm. Those were the terrible days for him, and I greatly admire him in retrospect for having survived them.
Yes. I wondered whether it left you, as I sometimes feel when I read some of the things you write, it left you with a certain distaste for feelings.
that they can overwhelm people, and in fact they lose control, which is very important to you, I feel.
But you see, I always view feelings as byproducts, not causes. And, for example, if I tell you that I came here today because I felt like coming, that might seem to you to be an explanation. Yes, I had this feeling that I'd like to do this, so I came and did it. But I would want to find out why I really came. I was invited to. I'd heard about these radio broadcasts of yours. All of these are the reasons why I am here. Now, they are also the reasons why I felt like coming, you see. So that both the coming and the feeling like coming are the product of the real causes. And it is not true that I came because I felt like coming.
No, I promised myself I would avoid getting involved in a theoretical discussion, but this one is a practical one. I know what you say, and I go with you a long way. But where I get puzzled is that I sense that you're very reluctant to include feelings then as part of things which in turn cause people to do certain things. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, in turn, yes. I object to the in turn.
Now, why can't in turn feelings join with previous events and lead us to certain things? How you are feeling, while it's not the be-all and the end-all to any inquiry into what you're going to do, is nonetheless relevant. Because if at the end of the day you'd felt unwilling to do the interview, then you wouldn't do it. And you're quite right, I'd have to find out a lot of other things as well. Okay. But finding out that you had a mixed feeling about it would have been relevant. Mm.
But what am I feeling when I feel like coming? I'm feeling my body. Mm-hmm. Now, that is not the way you might want to put it, but as far as I'm concerned, I am nothing but a member of a species and a physical, biological thing. And what I feel is evidence related to the probability that I will come. So that I am feeling the state of my body, which is the product of that past history that we've been mentioning. And then, in that sense, I am feeling the cause. But it isn't why, the feeling isn't essential. And of course, Freud and many others have pointed that out, that you are not always aware of the conditions of your body which lead you to do something.
Oh, quite. But again, making it personal and linking it with an aspect of your parents you've already remarked upon, the fact that you often felt your father was socially very ill at ease.
Yes.
And you wrote about staying in a hotel with your parents.
Oh, yes.
And that they didn't know how to behave. And you wrote, "I was as miserable as I have ever been."
Yes.
And another time, of course, your brother died.
Yes.
And you were there.
Yes.
And he died very suddenly.
He got
a headache and collapsed, and he was dead in a very short time. You describe it very objectively. Now, I would ask, how were you feeling?
Yes.
And I'll tell you why. Because some people have no feelings in such situations. They say they felt nothing, whereas others report the conditions, the experiences as of their body. And then, rightly or wrongly, psychiatrists make something of that. They distinguish between people who've different levels of feeling. Now, that's really what I wanted to put to you. Yeah. Because when you described the death of your brother, I wasn't sure what your feelings were, and I was interested.
No, and I don't know what they were in retrospect, and I don't think I could have put a name to them at the time. How do you describe feelings, after all? This is a very important point. I wrote a paper in 1945 on the way in which we can learn words referring to our bodies from people who don't know about them, you see.
Yes.
I can tell you what is red and what is green if you have color vision, but how do I tell you what is diffidence and what is embarrassment? How do I hold these up for you? Say, this is diffidence and this is embarrassment. I have to guess what you are feeling. Mm. And I can guess wrong. So that the language which describes feelings is by nature probably always inaccurate. And I would put it that way, that when my brother died, we were completely, it was an amazing thing. I just come back from a trip, and here my brother, I had been having a soda with him, with a friend, and in 5 minutes he was dead. Well, what What do you feel at that time? How can you put it? If you look at the way people describe feelings in literature, the main technique is to just use words. I could say, I was sad. Mm. That doesn't mean much. But in literature, you describe something that will lead the reader to feel. I felt like that, as Keats says, and then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken. If anyone can imagine what that was like, then you know how Keats felt when he looked at this book. I preferred, in general, simply to report what happened and to let the reader have the feelings.
In your example of feelings, you quoted a writer, Keats. You showed how, through his writing, he was trying to say something about an inner state.
Yes.
So that there is something in there. There are inner states, which we call feelings, which we cannot describe terribly well, which writers perhaps have some access to, but which scientists, such as yourself, are a bit detached about because they're so subjective.
No, I would want to change what you've just said just in one way. There are things in there. There are states of the body which you feel, but they are not feelings. You go to the dentist for the toothache. Does he cure the ache? He doesn't operate on the ache. He operates on the tooth. What you feel is the carious tooth. The feeling, you say, you call pain. Now, you have no word that describes that very well. What you tend to do is to describe things that cause pain. A sharp pain is caused by a sharp object. A dull pain is caused by a dull object.
Well, we have a language. It just isn't as good as you would like it to be.
Well, exactly. But we have no way of acquiring a better one because all we can do is refer to the external accompaniments. Many people have pointed this out, that all languages of emotion are metaphors. Mm. All words are metaphors.
You came anyway to the conclusion that perhaps it wasn't for you. You said, I had apparently failed as a writer, but was it not possible that literature had failed me as a method? One might enjoy Proust's reminiscences, share the emotional turmoil of Dostoevsky's characters, but did Proust or Dostoevsky really understand? Now, what I wondered was, what was it that you felt that they perhaps didn't really understand?
I thought they gave you such a convincing picture of their characters and what their characters did and what they reported feeling and probably felt, because they were themselves part of those characters. Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov, he is all of the four brothers, really. If you knew more about Dostoevsky himself and the horrible things he'd been through, you know, being lined up and to be shot and not shot and that kind of thing, you would find reasons why he behaved and said all of the things that his characters say. And so when he puts them down, it is very true to life because it is life. It's part of a real person acting and talking about action. And that is the kind of knowledge Dostoevsky had. And my pigeons have knowledge of being pigeons, but I don't know it. I don't know it. They have it, but because they behave exactly like pigeons.
This period in your life where writing had been a possibility, so some notion of this process, this method of coming to terms with yourself was there, but you turned away, and around this time, you went through what you'll have to forgive me as a psychiatrist might be described as a sort of crisis. Do you think in retrospect, looking back, that something was going on?
I would say that it was definitely an identity crisis in the sense in which I would define a person. We are all multiple persons, of course. We acquire repertoires of behavior in different places. The young man who goes away to university acquires a new repertoire that isn't at all like the repertoire with his family. And he's embarrassed when he brings a friend home and has to behave with one or the other of these persons. He has to be either the family boy or the university boy. And these are the conflicts we all face when we acquire different repertoires. Now, I think what happened at that time was that I had acquired a very effective repertoire in college. I got very good grades without too much trouble. I had aspirations to write. Frost had said I could write, and he thought I was a potential writer. And then I spent a year and nothing happened. Well, I simply abandoned that repertoire of behavior. That was extinguished, as we say, to be technical. And now, what was I to do? Well, temporarily, I had nothing effective.
Do you ever look back and think about your writing? Would you have liked to, in retrospect, to have somehow mined a seam?
As a matter of fact, T.H. Peer, who was a well-known British psychologist, asked a number of his friends to tell him the names they could remember of psychologists who had published books over their own names. And I think there were only two, and I was one of them. Yeah. Now, he argued that being a psychologist somehow interferes with your thinking the way a novelist thinks. And I'm not sure he isn't right, and that I have got past the point now of ever letting go and being the novelist that I was in a small way in writing Walton 2. I wrote that book in 7 weeks. Now, that's very fast for me.
Letting go, you used to say.
Yes, right. Letting go of all the strictures of don't do this, don't do that, and so on.
Yes.
Being exact when you say something, not worrying about that. Letting it come out and criticizing it later. That's the whole problem, of course. It's the whole problem of how you tease out what you have to say.
You mentioned Walden, too, the book about the utopian community with your principles applied. There's two characters, Professor Burris, who goes, the skeptical, doubtful.
They're essentially myself, I'm sure.
Yes.
They're aspects of myself.
Well, Fraser, it's the man who runs it. Now, there's a moment where he says something about himself. It's a moment of reflection, self-reflection. There aren't too many, but he says, you think I'm completely insensitive to my effect upon others, except where the effect is calculated.
Yes.
You can't see in me any personal warmth. You're sure that I'm one who couldn't possibly be a genuine member of any community. Shall we say that as a person I'm a complete failure and have done with it?
Yes.
He's talking there, Fraser, about himself in the sense, you see me as a cold fish.
That's right.
Now, is that something that people pick up or used to pick up from you at the height of your...
Yes. I have given that impression to many people. I'm unable to explain it, and many people have asked me about it, and they've said they couldn't explain it at all. But remember, Fraser goes on to say, yes, but I wasn't raised in Walden, too. It was my background that has made me this way.
Oh, true. But I'm interested that you say, yes, people have described me like that, but it puzzles me why. Now, I don't believe that for a word. You do know why. In all that I've read or seen written about you, and indeed even as I meet you now, you don't come across to me as a man who's, in that sense, emotionally on the bubble.
No.
Now, but the opposite, that is to say, someone who gives off a feeling, I don't know what other word to use, of control, coolness, not easily moved to anger. Would that not be a reasonable basis for why people think, this man's amazing, he provokes a lot of feelings in others, but he's very cool himself?
Well, I've learned not to react to criticism, fortunately, because I've got a great deal of it, of course.
You learned not to.
I learned from it, I think. Of course, there's always that possibility that I refuse to read my critics, as I very often do, as a matter of fact, and hence don't learn from them, but I dismiss them only when I have assured myself that they don't understand me. The famous paper by Chomsky's review of my book, his review has been translated into more languages than my book and reprinted many more times, and many people felt that it demolished my book. Well, it did so far as its reputation with linguists was concerned, so much the worse for linguistics. I felt that about it because he didn't understand what I was doing at all. Mm. Now, rather than write the kind of answer that many people would expect, using the same rather emotional tones that Chomsky uses, I simply have done nothing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it would have done me or the field any good to have got emotionally upset about it.
Closer to home, in your more personal relationships, your wife, your children... Have they ever said, made comment about your control, as you've just described it?
Well, I dare say my wife would say that I wasn't always under control.
She would say, always under control.
I have been critical and so on, and she had naturally resented that, properly resented it. I don't know. I, after all, we're still married after 47 and a half years. Mm. I think it's been a good marriage, as marriages go.
What did your wife mean when she was quoted as saying, when I met him, he was convinced he was a genius?
I don't know. I suppose I said it at the time, and or implied it at least. I don't take any satisfaction out of my position in the field of psychology as such. The things that are more important to me are still being active and trying to clarify things, straighten things out, give a better picture of what human behavior is all about. I'm stubborn. I've stuck to one position, and I think I've done very well, given my intelligence, whatever it is.
Of your two parents, which was the more influential as the conditioner, as the reinforcer?
I don't know. I suppose my mother is more responsible for the Protestant ethic that I have practiced, in the sense of wondering what people will think.
When did your mother die?
1960, 10 years after my father, 1950.
And again, after two deaths, which moved you the more, which affected you?
Oh, my father's death, yes. I was touched by him, and as I look back now, I feel much more warmth my attitude toward my father. I think my mother gave him a rather hard time. It was a question, really, of his never quite understanding people. His jokes in public were never quite the right thing, never quite the right tone, and it was clear that my mother was disapproving of him. Mm-hmm. I sensed it, too. I could see it. Mm-hmm. I could see that he never quite knew what to do.
Yeah.
And it was always, and as he moved on up into new environments, that lack was all the more crucial.
Knowing, predicting, controlling, they affect all of us, and one of the times when we're very preoccupied is when we have children of our own.
Yes.
They really stir up our notions of what we want, what we don't want, what we want to avoid. And you were at the heights of, well, you were well established as a behavioral psychologist, working mainly with laboratory animals and so on. And then, of course, you married, and you had your first daughter. Now, there's a lot of misunderstandings about the process whereby you reared her for the first 2.5 years.
That was the second daughter. That was Deborah.
That was Deborah.
Yes, the first daughter was Julie, but I had not learned my lesson by that time, so that we built the so-called air crib or baby tender
for Deborah.
For the second, Deborah.
Well, we can come back to Julie then, because that's an interesting experiment in its own right.
Yes.
Can you describe to me, because I'd forgotten about it until I was reading up again, that this had happened. What was this Skinner crib that you used?
Well, when the war was coming to an end, and we decided to go on and have a second child. And my wife said, I don't really mind bearing a child, but I hate that first year. The diapers, the wet bedding, and all of the trouble keeping the child covered. And Juliet had a lot of trouble with sore throats, and there were no antibiotics in those days. So I said, well, why don't we just analyze the problem and work out a way of keeping a child warm without wrapping it in blankets and sheets and nighties and underclothing of all kinds. So I simply built an enclosed space about the size of a crib, all glass on one side, humidified warm air coming up through a tightly stretched canvas, which is on what the baby lay, and the air passes up and goes out through baffled openings, and is thermally controlled. And so when Deborah came back from the hospital, we put her in this thing, and I don't think she ever has resented treating her as a guinea pig this way. They work perfectly. They move around very quickly. Many babies have been raised this way now. They're all way ahead of the old ordinary norms of turning over and so on. They grow up. I've seen many of them now in their 30s, and they tend to be tough, wiry people. I just can't believe you change body type with this, but they certainly get a lot more exercise as babies than any ordinary child.
Again, the element that's common to all of this is some kind of control, in that best or worst sense, it doesn't really matter for the moment. What I'm often a bit puzzled about is that in your system, in the way you think about life, there's not a great deal of space for the rebel, for no. somebody who will be different, mm-hmm. unpredictable, yes. even anarchic.
No, but what you're saying is that if IBM builds the perfect typewriter and no part breaks down, that that is a fault because others broken down, I would suppose that a well-designed culture would not need rebels.
Yes, I suppose
it would need, it would need experimental change in investigation. You never can stop with what you have. It's got to be, got to continue to develop. That's the whole principle of evolution, which is very close to operant conditioning and the selection of behavior. But why you need rebels, well, that's, the answer to that is that you haven't got a perfect system.
No, I suppose that that's the difference between people who are utopian and those who are not, that that you can still conceive of a society in which all the variables and all the conditioning and all the reinforcement is going precisely the way we, in our wisdom, we self-appointed experts in our wisdom, think it should go. But let me ask you, you wrote something, I think, this is at second hand because I haven't read your personal journal, but you're quoted as having written in your personal journal in the 1960s an interesting passage because, well, I'll read it and see what you have to say. You wrote, "Sun streams into our living room.
Yes.
My hi-fi is midway through the first act of Tristan and Isolde, a very pleasant environment. A man would be a fool not to enjoy himself in it. In a moment I will work on a manuscript which may help mankind. So my life is not only pleasant, it is earned or deserved. Yet, yet, I am unhappy."
Yes. I'm unhappy because, and that I think is the whole issue, momentary gratification, the things that are reinforcing to us, which we all strive for, which do not take into account the direction the world is moving, can be the great threat to the future. We do not really want to restrict ourselves in ways which will make a future more probable if that interferes with our current enjoyment. And you see people who tell you what they want in life, and they want it here and now. And those are the things which I think are the real threat to the human species, certainly to a given culture. And I want to take into account the good of the individual in the sense of giving the individual what is most important to him or her. But I want to take the future of the species into account too. And that will have some bearing on the extent to which we can at the present time enjoy all of the things we enjoy.
In many ways, you remind me of another psychologist, but very different one, an American. He comes from a background not unlike yours, and he's also a utopian. And I'm thinking of Carl Rogers.
Oh, yes.
And what is it, do you think, about that background that it seems to me, Midwest, well, you weren't Midwest, but
I was
small
not.
Town.
I was in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
Roger, which was
that's
was
right. But it, this utopianism, the notion that it usually comes out of a Judeo-Christian background, fairly punitive, strict, rather evil-oriented, if you know what I mean, certainly preoccupied by man's failure and flaw. And it produces people like you who are not insensitive, who know misery and unhappiness and evil, but seem to believe not just in a utopia in the very, very far distant, but almost one over the hill.
Yes, it was a great move in that direction in America, when you could move off into free country, free land, set up your own world. There were something like 200 utopian communities in the United States in the 19th century. Most of them were religious and perished because they were, because God doesn't change his mind. He tells you how to live, and then the world changes and you're left behind. But that was very much a part of my personal history. And I think it carries over to the present feeling in America that you can do something about the world. You can change it, make it your way. But of course, most Americans are simply concerned with making things the way they like to have them at the moment, and we're very insensitive to the problems which face us.
What about the one event for which we cannot be entirely prepared, that death?
Yes. I have no fear of death, and I really mean that. If I am in a plane and there's some trouble in the plane and so on, the thing I think about is whether I should finish the paper I'm working on. My family's well taken care of. I shall miss them, but I shan't be around to miss them. They'll miss me, I hope. I have no fear at all. I'm not religious. I don't expect that any part of me will survive except my works. That is the only kind of immortality anyone ever has anyway. I'm 80 years old now, and I want to make the best use of the time remaining to me, and that means taking some other drastic action about cutting down on things you really don't feel worth doing. Mm.
Looking back on your life, was there ever a time when you felt that you could have been emotionally devastated, that there was something that so shook you personally that it might
have... Well, I've gone through some pretty bad times when things haven't been going well, but I must say that I've been extraordinarily lucky. We're compared to what I read in the lives of other people. I've had luck. There's no question about that. I just happened to fall into a profession for which I was best prepared. I've never considered suicide, for example.
Never.
Nothing of that sort, no.
Yeah.
No, I must count myself lucky, and I think it is luck, and I think that's part of a deterministic position, that it doesn't have to be an important event that determines the future.
We're left, though, aren't we, with a huge gap.
Yes.
And this has a bearing when it comes down to something very personal, and that is how you reconcile two opposing and often difficult to reconcile desires. I mean, you mentioned it once in something you wrote about your wife. You said there's a problem doing things together. I walk faster and longer than she. She needs entertainment that I can do well without. What is a fair deal then? How much should be done to make her happy in spite of the fact that it'll make me less happy? Mm. That's to say, how do we decide what behaviors we will reinforce and what we won't, given that people are so at different stages of development, different desires, different needs?
Well, I shan't simply take a step back and say we're conditioned to do what we do. I would have to say that, really, but there's a more important issue here. We speak two languages, really. There's the everyday language of feelings and states of mind. I don't have the information, you don't have the information, anything beyond that. But in the laboratory where I can control conditions, I can investigate processes which I think are involved at this very moment between us. Now, that is the situation the astronomer finds himself in when he goes beyond the solar system and talks about space. He has a language, but he gets everything from that language from his research in the physics laboratory. He knows he has no control, and he can't predict. All he has are particles and waves striking the Earth. Now, shall we just go back and have him talk about the Big Bear and the Big Dipper and so on? No. We let him talk about these things with a vocabulary that he uses strictly with respect to high-energy physics and atom collisions and whatnot on Earth. In other words, he is merely interpreting what he sees in space, using a vocabulary he learned from tightly controlled experiments. And I am only interpreting your behavior, my behavior, as I talk about it here. My book, Verbal Behavior, was an interpretation of a very big, difficult field using principles derived from the laboratory where control is possible, but I don't pretend to be able to predict what anyone will say next.
Well, I think that's probably the moment where we leave it in that state of unpredictability.